Marijuana, Compassion, and Common Sense. The show that tells you the truth about marijuana, reveals the politics behind its prohibition, tries to clear up all that legal mumbo-jumbo that makes it so difficult and sometimes impossible for you to obtain this healthy, wonderful, healing herb. Okay, hey, welcome to another edition of Marijuana, Compassion, and Common Sense. We are so glad that you were able to join us for what's going to be a very wonderful and exciting show. You know, what we've got going on right now is, you know, a lot of states like California have legalized cannabis, and states like California and Oregon grow a lot more cannabis than they consume, but the problem is we can't ship it to another state. You know, if you're growing cauliflower or broccoli or beer, you can ship it to another state, but you can't ship cannabis to another state. Well, our guest tonight, Adam Smith, has come up with this rather unique plan that really seems like it could work to be able to allow for interstate commerce between states that have legalized the use of cannabis. So we're going to be bringing Adam on in about 5 minutes. But beforehand, I just want to talk about a couple little things here, and then we'll get on to Adam. Now, you know, I had sent out, if you're on my email list, I had sent out some email about the MORE Act. The MORE Act is the most important piece of cannabis legislation since the Controlled Substance Act made cannabis illegal in 1970. It was supposed to come up for a vote this month. I was going to send out an email saying, "Hey, folks, you got to call your representative, tell them to vote for this bill." But it didn't happen. Unfortunately. What happened was the Democrats put it off. They kind of wimped out, and this is unfortunate because this bill really would have done very wonderful things. One of the things that it would have done. The major thing it would have done is it would have removed cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act. By doing that, it would have ended federal cannabis prohibition. It would have legalized it, let the states do what they want to do with it, like alcohol and tobacco. It also permitted physicians affiliated with the Veterans Administration to write recommendations for medical marijuana in states that allowed it. It also incentivizes states kick their expungement policies into high gear, get people who have been convicted for low-level nonviolent marijuana offenses, get them off, get their records cleaned and off the books, and get them out of jail if they happen to be in jail. And it also allowed the Small Business Administration to support entrepreneurs and businesses as they try to get started in this emerging industry. But it didn't get passed. What happened was a number of moderate Democrats that are in districts which they were just recently reelected, you know, in 2018, a lot of Democratic districts, formerly Republican districts, got elected by Democrats. And they were worried that if bill was considered now, it would kind of make it seem like the Democrats considered marijuana more important than the COVID relief bills and so forth and so on. And they were afraid it would impact them. And that, I guess that kind of scared enough of the leadership, says, okay, we're going to put it off until after the election. But they said a guaranteed 100% it will be voted on after the election. So the Dems wimped out on that until later, and they unfortunately also seem to have wimped out another piece of legislation that would have promoted cannabis research. This was the Medical Marijuana Research Act, which would have allowed cannabis to be grown for research purposes in other places besides the government's pot farm in Mississippi, which, by the way, doesn't grow that good of marijuana. And this would allow researchers to get their cannabis from other places as well. It also would have established a simplified registration process. Right now, if a scientist wants to do research on cannabis, oh my gosh, you got your top level security clearance. It's incredible the amount of hoops you have to jump through. And this would simplify the process so scientists can get a hold of this cannabis and do their research far more easily. But it got put off. Now, as Dale Geringer noted that this research bill would have been considered under suspended rules. That means it would require a 2/3 majority vote to pass. You know what? even though the House of Representatives is very supportive of cannabis bills, it may not be that supportive of where two-thirds would vote in favor of. So it may very well have failed. So maybe it's just best to put it off until later. Okay, one other thing. For those of you who have got my newsletter, you're aware that the holders of medical marijuana ID cards here in California were up against a brick wall. Their cards were about to expire. Now, these cards are very important for two reasons. One, if you have a medical marijuana ID card, you don't have to pay sales taxes when you purchase marijuana. And if you purchase like $100 a month of marijuana, that's good savings. So you have to have the ID card. And also, it kind of gives you an upper foot, a better rung, if you have some kind of encounter with law enforcement. The fact that you have that ID card, they can ignore your doctor's recommendation if they really want to, but they can't ignore your ID card. So having the ID card, if you have encounters with the police, would be very helpful. But the problem was the card was set to expire. But the thing is, because of the COVID-19 crisis, all the county health departments are closed, and the law requires that you actually renew your card. You can't do it on the internet. They're still stuck in the 19th century or whatever. You got to go down to the health department and actually make an application to renew your card. So if the cards are going to expire, so in the email I sent out and lots of other organizations, cannabis organizations, sent emails to all their people, say, hey, contact Governor Newsom and ask him to extend the expiration date. He done it once before. We wanted him to do it again. Well, I guess there was enough people who contacted the governor because he issued this. Notwithstanding the one-year period set forth in Health and Safety Code Section 11362.745A, identification cards issued under Health and Safety Code Section 11362.71 that would otherwise have expired on or after March 4th, 2020, shall be valid through and including December 31st, 2020. So, if you have a medical marijuana ID card, even though it says it's expired, it ain't expired. It's good through the end of the year. And whether is COVID-19 going to be enough that the health departments will open up again? I sure hope so. But you know what? I wouldn't count on it. But what I would count on, is why you listen to the program today, and that is to learn about the interstate commerce of cannabis. Adam Smith, who is the president and the founder of the Alliance for Sensible Markets, is spearheading a coalition of a vast array of many marijuana organizations and businesses and so on to press for allowing the interstate commerce of marijuana between states that have allowed it. And he's come up with a very unique idea, and we're going to learn all about that. Adam, welcome to Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. You know, when I saw that article coming from it was in Marijuana Moment. When I saw that article, I read it, and I says, "Wow, this person actually has an understanding of how the machinations of government actually works." Because what you seem to come up with is very useful, but it might actually work. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in the cannabis industry, or business, or an advocate, or whatever? How did you get started with it?
So I come out of the drug policy reform movement side rather than the industry side. I've always loved cannabis, but when a long time ago in another lifetime, when I was in grad school in 1992, I was very interested in drug policy reform. I had run a youth program in New York before then, and so it was the height of the drug war, and I kept hearing politicians say, "Well, we're doing this to protect the children." And I kept saying, no, you're hunting the children, and we don't want you to get your hands on them. And so I had a sense that the drug war was a scam and was being foisted on false premises. And so when I went to grad school, I got really interested. And I got introduced to this guy. His name is Dave Borden. And he had started an email discussion list on drug policy. Now, this is 1992. I had an email for a week, and less than, I think, 1% of the country had email. So it was this weird technology, right? And I get on this discussion list, and there's like 25 people on it, and it's like three people doing needle exchange out of vans in the middle of the night, running from the police, and a couple of prison activists and some cannabis people. And it was the first place anywhere where people from different parts of fighting against the drug war came together to strategize. And I was fully sucked in. And so I spent I spent grad school really involved in that, and during that time the web happened, and this little email discussion list became an actual organization with multiple websites and multiple discussion lists, and it was called DRCNet, the Drug Reform Coordination Network. It's now called StopTheDrugWar.org. It still exists. And when I graduated, I went right down to Washington, D.C., to go end the drug war, because tearing down a $4 trillion global industry from a $30,000 a year job seemed like a totally reasonable thing to do at that time. And so I went down there, and the first thing I did was I started a weekly email news magazine to cover the drug war from the reform side, because the media at that time, they loved covering big drug busts, right? It's the mid-90s. And they rarely talked about policy, but when they did, it was all law enforcement and politicians. And the argument was, should we build more prisons or should we build a lot more prisons? And so that seemed to be, you know, pretty narrow focus, and those weren't the conversations we were having. And so I started covering the drug war, and instead of going for comment to law enforcement all the time, I went to folks who were actually doing the work, and reformers and academics and needle exchangers. And so I ended up really in the center of a lot of the work that was being done in drug policy reform. It was an amazing place to be. And then in 1998, President Clinton signed something called the Higher Education Act, which eliminated federal financial aid eligibility for any drug conviction. So if you had been popped with a dime bag at 15 years old, you are now lifetime ineligible for federal financial aid. And to me, you know, again, I had worked with kids. To me, this was sort of the microcosm of the drug war. We're going to show you how dangerous this is, but if we catch you with it, we're going to make sure you can never educate yourself the rest of your life. And I thought that was just totally insane and one of the dumbest things I had ever heard. So I wrote a resolution saying this is the dumbest thing we've ever heard. And out of our list of 30 or 35,000 people, we had about 1,200 EDU addresses, faculty and students. And I sent it out to all the EDU addresses. I said, take this to your student governments and your administrations and get them to sign on to this. We're going to change this. And so suddenly we had dozens of campuses organizing. And that part of the drug of the Higher Education Act ultimately got rolled back. It was the first federal drug war legislation, drug war era legislation that was ever rolled back. But out of that, we launched something called Students for Sensible Drug Policy, which is now in 30 countries and 40 states. And I didn't build that. We started it and I handed it off to the students. But that was my introduction to drug policy. And in the 20 years since, which I won't bore you with, I sort of got out of drug policy and did a whole bunch of other progressive political work. And then a few years ago, when Oregon was legalizing, when Oregon first passed their dispensary law, my wife, who I had known for 25 years, who also came out of drug policy initially, was working for the health department. And so she got pulled into rolling out the Oregon's state dispensary program because she had all this background in drug policy. And then when rec happened, she went over and helped roll out the state program. And so at that moment, I was ready to get back into drug policy. And I looked around Oregon, and Oregon has had an incredible cannabis industry for generations, right? And everyone was saying, oh, this is going to be Oregon's next great craft industry. And I sort of looked at the politics and the economics especially and thought, well, really what it looks like it's going to be is six Canadian agribusinesses and a bunch of tenant farmers, because you guys are starting to get wiped out. And so as an organizer, I said, look, we have an incredible craft industry here. How do we support it, right? And how do we organize it? And in order to organize it, you know, the first thing we needed to do was define it. And so we had months of conversations. How do you define craft cannabis in Oregon? We sort of know it when we see it, right? But there was no definition. And we went through a lot of, oh, these fertilizers and these inputs. And I said, no, we're not really looking to do technical standards. This is a political movement. And so what we ended up with was you were a craft industry in Oregon. If you were majority locally owned, you know, 51% owned in Oregon, and you stood behind a shared set of values. And those values came down to ethical business and employment practices, positive community engagement, environmental sustainability, and ending the drug war. And if you could stand behind that and you were a local business, you were one of us. So we started organizing something called the Craft Cannabis Alliance. And that was, and it was really necessary here, and people were excited about it. But during that time, as we were organizing, Oregon suddenly ended up with this huge glut of product, right? And in you know, 15 months, outdoor prices went from $1,800 a pound to $300 a pound, and everyone was on their way going out of business. And so, you know, and everyone's talking about oversupply. And to me, it became clear Oregon didn't have an oversupply problem. Oregon had a market access problem, right? I mean, when we legalized cannabis in Oregon, we did something that I think that was very Oregonian, and I think that was very wise, we tried to legalize the industry that we had. We understood that the industry here, you know, medical and unregulated, had been supporting lots of communities in some of the poorest parts of the state. And so we you know, the state ran a marketing campaign called Go Legal, and it wasn't come in with your Canadian public money and buy everybody out. It was, we know you're growing, whether you're registered medical or unregulated, come into the legal market. And thousands of people did, right? And but what we didn't think through very clearly is when we legalized the industry we had in Oregon was an export industry and had always been an export industry. Most of the cannabis has always left the state. And
yeah,
so,
you know, here in California, the Bureau of Cannabis Control had a study done by the California Department of Agriculture on that very issue. They wanted to know how much cannabis that people in California consume and how much is grown. And what the Department of Agriculture reported after about a year study is that California consumes 2.6 million pounds of marijuana every year, and it produces 13.3 million pounds of marijuana every year.
Right.
So obviously a lot of it was going out of state, and Oregon, of course, was in the same ballywick. They were producing way more than their consumers
right.
possibly could consume.
I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard to estimate. That's a great study because that starts to put some numbers on it, and obviously it's still an estimate, but it reflects reality is that Oregon and California have supplied probably 85% of the domestically grown cannabis sold in the country for as long as anybody can remember, right?
And it's also important, like you recognized, you talked about craft marijuana. Keith Stroop from Normal always has said that the best marijuana in the world is grown in California, and I think that probably extends up to Oregon as well. So what we grow, the people of the world deserve what we grow.
Exactly, right. I mean, the growing region, you know, it really goes from somewhere south of Eugene, Oregon, down to the bottom of the Emerald Triangle. And different strains grow better and worse in different, but you know, in different parts of that. But that is the best and most important cannabis producing region on the planet, right? And
yep.
So it became clear to me that really what I had to do, what had to be done, is we had to open the markets that those farmers have always accessed, and we had to open them legally. And we could wait around for legalization, but you know, we've been waiting for legalization for a very long time, and we have these legal markets, and now we have legal markets opening up, you know, on the East Coast. And we're about to watch, and I'll talk a lot about New York and New Jersey. We're focused on that as two consumer states, but we're about to watch, but they're indicative of other states where cannabis doesn't, you know, ordinarily grow. We're about to watch hundreds of millions of dollars be invested in hard asset factories to grow every ounce of biomass for tens of millions of people under light and temperature control and humidity control. It's gonna the investment up front is insane, and the operating cost, the energy usage to do that is absolutely irresponsible. And so we need to you know, New York and New Jersey and other states going forward need to legalize in a way that recognizes that the cannabis industry flows west to east and always has, and there are lots of really good reasons for it. And the other side is that when federal legalization happens, the U.S. Constitution, the Commerce Clause, forbids states from discriminating against the products of other states, right? You can't keep California oranges out of Florida, even if you wanted to, right? It's not constitutional. And so the minute federal legalization happens, West Coast cannabis is going to flood those markets, and suddenly you're going to look at hundreds of millions of dollars of hard asset investments that are going to be suddenly non-competitive, and why would anybody purposely go down that road? We have legal markets. We must let markets operate. Markets exist to move products from where they're most efficiently produced to where there's greatest demand. And that is the whole purpose of markets. We have legal markets. We need to move forward in a way that reflects sanity and reality and the future of what the industry is, which is not growing biomass for tens of millions of people under lights.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, here in California, Proposition 64, when it was originally written, it didn't have any restraints on acreage size. It was kicked in there, and when it was because so many small growers complained that they would be put out of business stuff, they put in a 5-year moratorium on large-scale cannabis growing. But in 2023, that moratorium comes off. And that's going to mean that our California farmers, and I believe that the Central Valley is really going to be a great place to grow cannabis, can start growing hundreds and thousands of acres of cannabis. Like California
right.
exports so much of the food for this nation, California
right.
and Oregon, of course, in the Willamette Valley, will export tremendous amounts of cannabis to throughout the country. And that's
and
why
it's inevitable.
We have to legalize it for interstate right. commerce.
Right. And so we are I am a strong supporter of federal legalization. I've been fighting to end the drug war for, on and off for a very long time. But we can't wait for that. The other thing, and I think a lot of your audience will appreciate this because I'm sure a lot of them are in the industry, is that we have an opportunity if we can connect Oregon and California with states like New York and New Jersey and create, under an interstate compact, can create a regulatory framework for commerce and get that moving.
Would you explain what an interstate compact is?
Of course. Currently something like 200 active interstate compacts. And what they are is when two or multiple states get together to create regulatory frameworks around something that doesn't necessarily impact all of the other states. And it goes everything from rivers and water usage to the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey that does transit in the metropolitan region. And so interstate compacts are outlined in the Constitution, right? And states can often just enter into them and begin operating under them. But in many cases where there are federal laws or regulations that are impacted or touched upon, Congress needs to approve them. And so what we are looking to do is get, and we are working with some partners to put together model language, but we are hoping by the end of March to have multiple governors, at least two, but we're hoping for at least four, agree to an interstate compact on how we would regulate commerce between these legal markets. And that will go to Congress for an up or down vote. And we think that we can talk later about Congress and where things are with federal legalization. But I am of the belief that with everything going on in the country, with an economic crisis and a healthcare crisis and a social awakening and everything that's happened with this current administration, that you have possibly Joe Biden coming in, who is no great champion of legalization. I don't think that Congress is going to take it up and try to shove it down Joe Biden's throat in 2021. I think ultimately he will get there, but we're going to have to wait for that. And so there is no reason for the legal markets that are operating to wait, and that it will be a much easier lift in Congress to approve as an amendment or a rider to the appropriations bill or even a standalone bill, much easier to approve an agreement between states that doesn't impact anybody than to try to federally legalize in 2021, which will take a lot of oxygen and time and energy. And I just don't think it's going to happen. And the tagline for the campaign, the name of the campaign is States Can't Wait. We can't wait, right? If we are walking into a generational jobs crisis, and with this one small change, right, we don't the industry doesn't need a bailout or a handout. With this one policy change to allow markets to function, you will immediately see thousands of farms and businesses in producer states that will have their valuations increased by multiples, right?
It will stem crime, because right now California, Oregon ships a lot of its cannabis out
right.
of state anyway, so this would
right.
take all this stuff that's illegal and lining the pockets of criminals and no taxes and this kind of stuff, bring it into the legal market.
Right. And so you'll see investment and expansion and jobs on the West Coast. In the consumer states, what you hit on is we'll be able to move tens of millions of people out of illicit markets years sooner than what we're seeing now, which is 3 to 5 to Lord knows how many years till they get supply chains up and running, right? We could get New York and New Jersey's industries up and running with stable supply chains in 6 to 18 months, as fast as they can regulate retail distribution delivery. We'll move millions of people out of illicit markets. You'll have a wave of investment and business formation and tens of thousands of jobs in the middle of a recession. And there's something I just want to point out, because I talk a lot about investment and jobs and expansion, but there are also all of these small craft farmers all over Northern California and Southern Oregon. They're not looking to expand, but they deserve the right to access the markets they've always access and to get the best price for their products. And so they don't have to look for investment, and they don't have to be struggling to survive. And so whether companies and firms are looking to expand, you know, or not, this is something that will solidify the industry and create a boom for everyone. And waiting around for legalization is a recipe for watching more and more of these folks struggle and go under.
Absolutely. And it just makes such good sense. You know, you have a lot of other organizations that are joining you in this. I was fairly impressed by the short list that I saw, but it said there's a lot more. What are these groups, and what are they? How are they involved in bringing this about?
So there right now on our website, there are between 50 and 60 groups that are listed, although more are coming in all the time, and I'm sort of scrambling to get to get that, you know, to get those up and get those out there. But some of the key organizations are the Origins Council, which is Jean Coleman, who's brilliant and has done amazing work on appellations and done so much work with the County Growers Associations and, you know, all through the legacy regions of California. And also we have quite a number of the County Growers Alliances from Northern California who are involved. That is really foundational for me. If this isn't going to be in the interest of the farmers and the legacy markets, then it's not something we should do. We have an ethical responsibility to make sure that there's a good place in this industry for them. We also have the Minority Cannabis Business Association, who's very concerned with equity, and there's a really strong argument, particularly in consumer markets, that siloed markets are a real impediment to true social equity, to empowering small businesses in those places, right? I mean, in New York, so I grew up in New York, right, and in New York City. And in New York City, over a 20-year period, we arrested 430,000 people for cannabis offenses, right? 86% of them were Black and Latino, right? And so there is a real, you know, there is a real moral imperative to find pathways to equity in those consumer markets. But when they have tried to legalize over the last couple of years in New York, and last year Governor Cuomo had a legalization bill and it didn't pass, and it didn't pass in significant measure because legislators of color looked at it and said, we don't see a real pathway to economic power here. You know, expungement is great, but no harm, no foul does not repay us. We need to be a piece of it. And they've had real trouble finding that. And the reason is that, you know, New York has had a cannabis industry for generations. It's an import industry. It's always been an import industry, and tens of thousands of people have paid their bills by doing this. A few people have gotten rich, and too many people have gone to jail, but most people have been grinding and paying bills. But suddenly when you legalize and mandate that everything needs to be grown in the state, you turn those economics on their head, and inevitably all of the economic power goes to a small handful of companies that can invest $50 or $60 million to build giant factories. And if they're going to create all of the biomass in the state, everyone is subservient to them. Whereas if we allow the industry there to be legalized in the way that it has always functioned, you'll have thousands of small businesses with access to thousands of the best suppliers in the world. They can differentiate their business. They can build their own economic power. And so the Minority Cannabis Business Association is also a foundational partner, and their understanding that the economics mandate that we not create siloed industries, that we cannot get to social equity that way unless we allow the industry to function, where the economic power is really in the hands of retail distribution, delivery, small manufacturing, product development, where it's always been and where the barriers to entry are far lower. So beyond that, we have the New York City Cannabis Industry Association. And that's important because they're involved in putting in trying to advocate for regulations in New York, and dozens and dozens of other businesses and associations, and more are coming in every day. And really, for your listeners, if you are a license holder or an allied business, we want your endorsement. Come to the website. It's at sensiblemarkets.org. You can also find us at statescan'twait.org. And put your name on the list as an endorser. And if you make a contribution to the cause, because it's going to cost us some money to do this, we will get your logo up on our page. And we'd love to have your support. It's how we're going to make this happen.
Yeah, very much so. Listen, we've got to take a little break for a couple minutes. I'd like to get back and talk with you a little bit about if you've talked to any elected officials and see how they react to that. So I'm going to put you we'll just hang on for about 2 or 3 minutes. We'll be right back with you, Adam.
I'm here.
Okay. I now want to talk about one of our things that I always talk about when we do our show here, and that is you can help us by – we've got a wonderful wonderful object, the art that you would love to own. It is Higher Power 420. It's a gorgeous and mind-boggling print depicting everyone's favorite deities in a joyous 420 celebration. Conceived by moi and artistically rendered by Shane Mass Creation Hibbets, Higher Power 420 is an engaging, thought-provoking, and satiric look at the foibles of religion and the role marijuana can play in today's polarized and estranged world. It's wonderful. What it is, like I said, everybody's favorite deity is there, and they're all consuming cannabis one way or another, and they're enjoying each other's supernatural company. And it's just fun to look at. It's a gorgeous 16 by 20 print, and now you can have it for just $5. That's right, $5, and you could be the first on your block to have this gorgeous Higher Power 420 print displayed on your wall, or it makes a wonderful gift. So how can you get it? You can get it by going to higherpower420.com, and you'll see there the price says $24.20, but it's being changed to just $5. So take a look at it and be sure and order one right now. Okay, and the other thing is, I talked a little bit about the newsletter I put out. I talked about how we talked about how Governor Newsom, we asked him to extend the deadline, and we got the deadline extended on the ID card stuff. My little newsletter comes out once or twice a month. It doesn't come out very often, so I can assure you, you're not going to get your already overcrowded email box just literally filled with all kinds of stuff I think you just have to read about cannabis. No. This is just a very specific newsletter. It comes out once or twice a month, and it also has information about our now virtual meetings of MAP, and we're going to be having our first virtual meeting this coming Saturday at 1 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, and you can Pacific Standard Daylight Savings Time, and you'll be able to call in, and our guest is going to be Ellen Comp from Cal Normal, who's going to be talking about a normal Smoke the Boat list. They have this incredible list of candidates that they have interviewed and got feedback from, so they're going to give everybody all these candidates' positions on marijuana. They rate them from A to F. It's a very thorough list, and she's going to be talking about the candidates that you're going to be seeing on your ballot. So join us. That's going to be this Saturday at 1 o'clock, and to get information on how to do that, go to my website, marijuananews.org. That's one word, marijuananews.org, and in the masthead, you'll see it says this newsletter. Click on newsletter, sign up for it, and you'll receive that newsletter, and you'll get information how you can join us at our virtual meeting. Okay, well, let's go back to Adam. And Adam, tell us a little bit, have you approached any elected officials about this idea of the Interstate Compact? And if so, what has been their reaction?
Yes. So first of all, before I do that, I want to say I've known Ellen Comp for 25 years, and your listeners should clearly definitely get on and hear what she has to say. She does incredible work, and has been so important to the movement and the industry. And you should buy the thing from Lanny, because you need to support your local and cannabis-focused media centers, because Lanny is the guy who's giving you the real information about what's going on, and I guarantee he's not making a ton of money doing it, and him and his team do an amazing job, and you should support the show. So now, having said that, you didn't pay me to say that. I just wanted to let your folks know. So back to your question. So in Oregon, we spent a long time talking with legislators about this, and we passed the bill with the strong support of the governor that will allow Oregon to enter into these agreements. We have made good progress in the California legislature getting awareness around this issue, and a lot of our partners in California have done so as well, and to Governor Newsom's office. And what we are seeing is more and more elected officials starting to talk about the importance of opening markets. Because once you explain it to folks, particularly in Oregon and California, they understand that this is the center of cannabis production in the U.S. and really in the world right now. And the survival of the industry and the success of the industry and the communities that have depended on cannabis for so long really are dependent upon opening markets. And so the response you've gotten politically has been actually very, very strong. And we feel very good about getting both governors' support on this as we move forward. I don't want to say that, you know, we've had either governor stand up and say they're going to sign an interstate compact. That has not happened yet, but we have not asked yet. But we have gotten strong support, and now we are starting to make inroads in some of the consumer states. And the response we've gotten politically is very strong. The interesting thing about this is, you know, my general experience, I sit down with somebody who thinks I'm going to talk to them about something terribly radical and out there. And within about 15 to 20 minutes of conversation, everybody says, oh, this makes total sense. And so the more we can get this out, the more political support that we have gotten, and we expect that to continue.
Well, you know, it's kind of becoming mainstream so much. So, you know, one-third, I guess 23 states now have medical marijuana, and 11 have recreational, and three
mm-hmm.
states are voting on it in November, North Dakota,
right.
Arizona, and, God, I can't think of the third
Jersey.
State.
New Jersey,
that's right. And they're probably going to pass
yep.
in all three states. That's what they're saying. So it's become so, you know, that's what the people want. And I think most politicians are beginning to realize that. And with the COVID-19 crisis and the economic crisis and this kind of stuff, what a perfect new industry to come along and help provide lots of good jobs and to provide new tax revenues and, of course, to provide a product that is also of great benefit to the community.
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100% true. And also, as this new industry comes in, we are now sort of past the point of arguing that it should be legal, right? I mean, at some level, that's been accepted. Right now, the question is, how does it become legal? And because of what cannabis is, and because of what cannabis means to so many people on so many levels, and has for thousands of years, it is very important that this industry that this industry do this the right way, right? If we watch this industry become immediately corporatized, and there's always going to be place in a legal cannabis industry for large companies. We're not against large companies, but if we do this wrong, there's a very good chance that the vast majority of the industry will end up in a very few concentrated hands. And given the history of prohibition, and given what this plant means, we cannot allow that to happen. Right, the success and the benefits of legal cannabis must be broadly shared, right? And the folks who built and suffered to make this industry happen must have a place to build economic power and equity in this industry. And it is on us to do this. And so this is our moment. We are done arguing that it should happen. Now we have to demand that it happen in the right way. So we have an industry
absolutely.
That we like.
Absolutely, we have to get the people who've been involved in providing cannabis for decades need to be able to get into this industry. You know,
right.
I always thought that what's going to happen, it's kind of like here in California, I always thought the cannabis industry would kind of mirror the wine industry, where you do have some rather large corporations like Gavo and Mondavi that
right.
Produce. But, you know, really, for most of them, they do have their own farms. But for the most part, as I understand it, they contract with farmers to grow
mm-hmm.
for them. And then they
right.
just kind of market the product. And I think you'll probably see that in cannabis, too, with some nationwide brands. But I think you'll also see just, you know, like here in California, we have thousands of wineries, mom-and-pop
right.
wineries, producing their own very, very good product. In fact, what's interesting, some of these mom-and-pop wineries, their stuff is being sold in Costco. So
right.
I think that's probably what we're going to see, which would sort of, yeah, there's a room for the big companies, but there's also a lot of room for individual growers and processors and manufacturers. And I think, would they be able to access, how would a small grower be able to get involved in this interstate? I mean, see, when you say interstate compact, it's going to say, oh, my gosh, that's only big business. But how would a small
nope.
individual grower or manufacturer get involved in something like that?
So the states sign the compact, and they will create the rules. And so that may mean in New York that it can be sold into a distributor, right? Or it could mean that it can be sold from producers directly into specific retailers. We are going to argue to have this happen in ways that provide the broadest opportunities and the broadest, you know, choices of how folks want to run their business and sell their products. And so, you know, a small farmer could, you know, it depends. Do you want your own brand? Well, maybe we can, as this campaign happens, you know, we are going to be pulling together producers, but also folks who are going to be looking to do retail distribution delivery in states like New York or New Jersey. And, you know, you can build relationships with specific distributors or retailers for your small niche brand. You can, you know, multiple farmers could operate as a co-op under a brand or several brands and sell into you know, distributors in New York or retailers in New York that, you know, so they have a larger scale brand to sell. Or like you said, you could end up selling at a much better price to large brands that need product to put under their label. And so I think it will operate, you know, very much like the local industry operates, just, you know, at greater distances. And I want to not forget to mention, because everyone asked this question, is about transport, right? How do you get it across the country if it's still federally illegal? And because the interstate compact has to be approved by Congress, once that happens, the federal government has essentially said, yes, this is allowed, and we would be able to put product on trains or in the air, which are federally regulated and which don't have the ability for some Yahoo sheriff in Idaho, just to pick an example, to, you know, pull over a truck and cause problems.
So so if you have interstate commerce, what you're saying is that if you're driving a truck through a state that doesn't allow it, they could pull that truck over.
Yes. I mean, ultimately, you want to create an agreement with the states in between, right? And that's intergovernmental, that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And when federal legalization happens, they won't be able to do it. It's an interference in legal interstate commerce, right?
Well, you wouldn't be able to do it by train either, because train goes through states that don't allow it.
Well, yes, but it's federally regulated. The states can't.
Oh.
The states can't. Right. It's under federal regulation. It's not the Highway Patrol or the local DA. Right. But the truth is, if we have multiple governors who have agreed to do this and set up the regulatory framework, and you have the federal government that says, yes, you can do this, if we get down to arguing about, you know, about transportation, we've already won. Right. I mean, it's going to get there. And so, but we can do it by train and we can do it by air.
You know, there's a good chance that in the next Congress that the MORE Act will get passed and signed into law. How will that affect the idea of interstate? Will you still need interstate commerce compact, or will once the MORE Act passes, that's just going to solve all the problems?
Well, it doesn't solve all the problems, because once that happens, then you have the beginning of the process of the federal government coming up with regulations, right? And so that could take a year, right? And after something like the MORE Act, at least, I'm, you know, being generous and kind. And so, but it would certainly clear the way for interstate commerce between states that have already figured out a regulatory framework that they want to use, right? And so this would move that process along much, much faster, number one. Number two, my sense politically, you know, so if Trump wins, I'm not sure what happens, right? Although I don't think, my understanding is politically that he doesn't have a philosophical issue with cannabis. If they send it to him, if the Congress sent it to him, and there's Republican support for it, you know, I believe he'll sign it, but I don't want to try to predict what Donald Trump
will
do.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think he will sign it. The problem is going to be in the Senate. If the Senate remains under Republican control under Mitch McConnell,
it's going to be hard.
I don't think anything's going to get to his desk.
And so certainly not full federal legalization, right? And so, but under a Biden administration, here you have Joe Biden, who I've been fighting against Joe Biden since the crime bill in '94, right? I disagree with him on almost everything. I will be voting for him because I think that it's existential at this point, but that's a different conversation. But he is clearly no champion for federal legalization. The DNC, when they put their platform together, gave him an out. They did not put legalization in the platform. They said, we want the states to take the lead. The Bernie Biden committee that came together to make recommendations also gave him an out. They did not, surprisingly, call for a federal legalization. They called for allowing the states to take the lead. I don't believe when we walk into 2021, no matter who's in charge, but even if the Democrats are in charge of the Senate, we have a major public health crisis. We have a major economic crisis. We have a social awakening and all the issues that brings. And maybe we have multiple investigations about what's happened. Now, I don't see in that environment Congress taking the time and energy and oxygen to try to shove federal legalization down Joe Biden's throat in year one. I just don't see it happening in year one. I think Biden will eventually get there. I think they may do it before the 2022 midterms, but I would be very surprised, even if the Democrats take over, that given everything, if they spend the time and energy to really do good, you know, a good legalization, you know, federal legalization bill. And so we think this is necessary to get commerce going, because again, you know, the states can't wait. New York and New Jersey need the jobs in the industry, and we need the jobs in the industry, and the licensees and the allied businesses need this industry to succeed and can't wait around for two or three or four or how many years until the feds get their act together.
Absolutely, absolutely true. We can't wait. The health of the nation can't wait either, because cannabis is so important for healthy and safe and communities. Well, listen, I want to thank you for joining us. Is there anything else you? I mean, if people want to get hold of you, get more information, how can they do that?
Well, first of all, you can follow us on social media at States Can't Wait. Instagram, we're just getting our social media going. Be patient. There's stuff, but it's going to, you know, we've just sort of launched the public part of this campaign in the last few days. States Can't Wait on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And you can find us on the web and sign up as an endorser. And we really need, you know, large numbers of companies to stand up and say we want this to happen. That's going to help us with the governors. And you can find us at statescan'twait.org or sensiblemarkets.org. They both go to the same place.
So, Adam, one last question. You know, you've been involved, you know, you started with drug policy reform. You've not gotten to this cannabis thing. So once cannabis is federally, and you said 2022, you think it might actually be legalized.
Maybe.
But sometime in the next 3 or 4 years, I think it's going to come along.
Oh, yeah.
What are you going to do then?
I don't know. I have friends I grew up with in New York. I'm gonna be the guy when I go home to visit that brought amazing, you know, California and Oregon cannabis to them legally, and maybe I will never buy it. Maybe I will never buy a drink again at another bar in New York City. I don't know. I will figure it out. But this is so important, and I've spent the last couple of years really focused on making this happen, and I'm really excited about where we are. And so I'm gonna, you know, we're gonna succeed on this. We're gonna get interstate commerce by 2021. We're gonna set the industry off on an economically, environmentally, and socially just and sane path, and then I'll figure it out. You know, if I can avoid taking a job, that would be great.
Well, if anybody deserves a high-paying position within the cannabis industry, it's got to be you, Adam. Listen, thank you so much for joining us. I hope this works. I think your idea, you know, we've got. If we want to make sure that cannabis is never going to be made illegal again, it's got to be turned into a big business where people have so much money invested in it that they will fight like dogs to make sure that they have the right to continue to grow and manufacture and sell and this kind of stuff.
Lanny, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you. You do a great show. I'm honored to be here, and I will be back anytime you want me.
I'll keep that in mind. Thank you, Adam. Bye-bye.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Okay, that was Adam Smith from Sensible Markets. And what could be more sensible than a sensible market for cannabis? You know, I've mentioned several times in the show, I really, really am so, you know, to me, it's so important that cannabis be made widely and easily available. It's such good medicine for so many things. You don't need all those prescription pharmaceuticals. And, of course, for me as a retired nurse, I really believe that cannabis is the only viable alternative out there to alcohol, which causes so much problems in this country. Over $200 billion a year in health care costs and lost productivity and this kind of stuff from alcohol. And cannabis is a wonderful substitute for that. So we've got to get it going. And Adam's idea about interstate compacts and this kind of stuff, that is wonderful. I certainly hope it comes into being. Well, I want to thank you once again for joining us here today on Cannabis, Marijuana, Compassion, and Common Sense. We like I said, we don't do the shows all the time now, but please tell your friends about our show. It's right here on blogtalkradio.com/marijuana news. Thank you very much, and we're going to wind the show up like we generally do with Annette Shaw and her wonderful song, Lead the Way.
Plans already. all they have to show.